If you're looking for the latest and greatest ways to take control of the monthly expense you have the most influence over, you've come to the right spot. Welcome to the Efficiency Insider UCAS series. I'm Jeff Julia, award-winning author and founder of Energy Project Advisors.
Today, I'm interviewing my good friend, Prath Reddy. Prath is an investment banking director at UBS, the largest Swiss banking institution in the world. He has studied the energy sector for the past 7 years, originating bonds for utility companies. If all this sounds like Chinese, great. In this amazing episode, you'll learn how utility companies raise money, decide which fuels power your home, and how prohibition in the 1920s still impacts us nearly 100 years later.
Yeah, because there's two of you on here.
Say the point you want to make the point, and relay the point
to say. It's a real treat to have Prath on the show. So, Prath, welcome.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it. Glad to be on.
Let's just start off. When people hear the term investment banking, they don't immediately know what that means or how their utility companies are involved. Could you explain what an investment bank does and make it really tangible for the audience to relate?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. I guess the term investment banking, if you kind of break it down, it's nothing more than a bank whose customers are companies. If you think about when, you know, anyone that's listening to this podcast, you know, your relationship with the bank, you have a checking account, you have a savings account, you might have some credit cards with them. Well, for companies, they bank with commercial banks, but as well as investment banks. And investment banks give them all sorts of products and accounts that they can use to manage, you know, their business operations and their ability to kind of fund themselves going forward and finance investments and initiatives. So the investment word within investment banking really comes down to what the bank is offering these clients. So when a company raises money, they usually do it either in the form of equity or in the form of debt. For equity, usually that means stock. And if it's a publicly traded company, then they're going to list, you know, securities and specifically equity on like a nationally recognized stock exchange like New York Stock Exchange. And if it's debt, then, you know, they're going to issue bonds. And bonds are nothing more than loans that rather than the money coming from banks, it's actually coming from a pool of investors. And the bank kind of sits as the intermediary between the company that's, you know, trying to raise this money, either in equity or debt, and then the investors on the other side that want to buy that equity or debt. So how that kind of loops into utility companies, most of the larger utility companies in the U.S. happen to be large publicly traded companies that are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Some of the bigger players hold kind of somewhat monopolies in certain regions. And as an investment bank, it's our, you know, duty and obligation to these clients to help them navigate the various equity and debt capital markets whenever they want to raise money for funding any type of investment that they're trying to look to fund in their regions. And this could also include them acquiring other utilities to become bigger, have larger scale, and hopefully kind of service their, you know, their clients and their territories better.
Got it. When a utility company is working with you to create bonds, what kind of projects are they doing this for?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a host of different things. Typically, utility company will have two different types of investments in any given year. The first investment's kind of called maintenance capital expenditures. So that goes into kind of making sure that the existing infrastructure continues to get the proper investment to run and operate efficiently and smoothly. So it's literally like, you know, sending out crews to fix like down telephone poles and upgrade, you know, certain areas of the grid that just, you know, might be seeing more load capacity because more people are, you know, beginning to move into those areas, literally just maintaining the existing network. And on the other side of the investment landscape, they're also trying to raise money for growth CapEx or growth investments. And that could mean anything between acquiring a smaller utility in the area so that they can expand their footprint, or it could mean building a generation plant to, you know, actually source the energy that they need to distribute to their customers. It could mean building transmission lines from scratch to access certain areas of their grid that are currently not being supported. So anything that's beyond the scope of what they already have kind of falls into that growth bucket.
Got it. So when a city is growing and there's more demand being placed on the electric grid, these utility companies work with an investment bank to raise money to meet that growing electric demand, expand the grid, maybe purchase a smaller utility company within that local region, inevitably increase the energy capacity the electric grid has, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the companies themselves will have internal groups focused on these types of initiatives. So we really come in as external advisors to help them think through those ideas, as well as provide them the capital and the resources to actually get it done.
Got it. So what are some of the common challenges these utility companies face? The government regulations, you know, these bonds need to be approved by voters.
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. I would think that the biggest hurdle that these utility companies have to face all the time is their regulators. And the regulators are these, government entities called public utility commissions, or right. PUCs for short. So these PUCs, they pretty much are the regulators for every one of these utilities in their specific jurisdictions. And these guys really, you know, set the exact amount of money that any one of these utilities can make in any given year. They, you know, establish a certain return on equity that, you know, they can't surpass in any given year. And really they're there to protect the end user, the end electric customers. Because these utility companies are essentially monopolies, these PUCs have come in to kind of help protect the interests of, you know, these captive customers effectively. You know, they determine how much the utility can invest in whatever projects that they bring forward to the commission, how much it can charge, what kind of profit margins can be had. So really they're operating at the mercy of the public utility commissions all the time.
Now this applies also to people and businesses who pay a natural gas bill too, not just an electric bill, correct?
Yeah, that's certainly the case, because the infrastructure is very similar. And I believe that some PUCs have kind of the authority to also regulate the distribution and the sale of natural gas as well.
What are some of the growing issues that utility companies are facing in the energy markets in general? I mean, is it rising costs? Is it increase in regulations? I mean, are international conflicts impacting prices? Give us a lay of the land. What all is going on in the energy space right now?
Traditionally, these utility companies have enjoyed, you know, the monopolies that we've talked about, kind of being in those target service areas. And while, you know, they have to answer to the PUCs, you know, they do enjoy kind of, you know, all the benefits of being a monopoly. Now, the rise of kind of rooftop solar and, you know, customers kind of taking energy consumption and creation into their own hands is definitely a challenge that I think a lot of these utility companies are going to have to face going forward. You know, how are they going to balance the amount of money that they're going to be charging to their customers when their customers kind of turn around and say, well, we don't really need all that energy that you're providing us to begin with. You know, we're providing our own. So that's obviously directly going to impact utility companies' ability to, you know, generate a return on equity that's compelling to their equity and debt investors at the end of the day. So, you know, I think some of the ways that utility companies are grappling with this is by building out as much renewable generation as they can, and, you know, essentially offering customers a pathway to, you know, consuming green energy without necessarily having to invest in green energy themselves. So, and in reality, you know, that's exactly what we kind of want to see across the country. We want to see where these utility companies source their energy from become greener over time, because, you know, I don't think that everybody is capable of harvesting their own energy at the end of the day. There's people that live in apartment buildings. There's corporations that just don't have the bandwidth to do so. You know, not everybody has a house, you know, in Arizona with 3 acres of land where they can harvest their own energy. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good trend. And, you know, I think some utility companies across the country are doing a better job than others, trying to get ahead of the curve. I'd say the ones in the South and ones that are in, you know, service territories that have greater, you know, sunlight exposure and just greater land to work with have certainly become the leaders in the utility space. Whereas others that kind of operate in more confined environments or where the political landscape isn't exactly, you know, conducive for them to switch from coal or, you know, something else that's less green to something that is more green because the politicians in the area just don't want it to happen or the customers in that area just don't want it to happen. So, you know, I'm thinking of like a West Virginia, you know, coal mining town or somewhere, you know, somewhere else where, you know, there just isn't as much demand for, you know, going from dirty to green.
Yeah, Pennsylvania to Wyoming.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, that's a great segue to this next point I want to discuss with you. I'll talk a little about the generation of electricity. It's easy to just assume that there's one single source for the energy that supplies my home and my business. Mm-hmm. But that isn't necessarily the case, is it?
No, not at all. You know, utility companies, they source their energy from various different pockets. And some of the pockets that they actually source it from isn't energy that they themselves are creating. So for instance, if you look at, you know, any of these large public utility companies, whether it's, you know, Southern Company down south or Duke Energy or, you know, Sempra or NextEra, all these guys, if you put up a pie chart next to each one of their names, you're going to see a different breakdown of exactly where they're getting their, you know, load capacity from. There's a certain percentage that's, you know, these days now more and more being allocated to green, whether that's in solar, wind, or hydro or geothermal. And then you have a good chunk of that pie coming from natural gas. And that just has been the case for the last 10, 15 years. You've seen that slice of the pie grow just given the availability of cheaper natural gas across the country, thanks to the shale boom and domestic energy companies being able to, you know, pump that stuff out of the ground cheaper. And then you still see, you know, varying degrees of power coming from coal generation. And like I said before, there's some regions that have higher percentages coming from that than others. And lastly, there's kind of a segment for nuclear. And nuclear is an interesting one because, you know, it is considered to be kind of a green energy for sure because it's just so sustainable over time and doesn't really have huge impacts to the environment. But, you know, these are legacy systems for the most part. These are nuclear plants that were built back in, you know, the 50s, 60s and 70s that continue to operate. There are a couple new nuclear generation plants that were being constructed down south, namely in the Southern Company and Duke Energy and South Carolina Gas and Electric. Those three companies together were kind of building new nuclear plants, but there was kind of a spat over the contractor that was building those plants and the contractor filed for bankruptcy and it was a Japanese owned company. And yeah, if you read up all about it, it was this whole Westinghouse case, and Westinghouse was the contractor that was building these three large nuclear plants down south for these, you know, U.S. traded public utility companies. And Westinghouse was majority owned by a Japanese conglomerate, which obviously posed some political risks. But at the end of the day, you know, one of them had to be scrapped more or less. And the other two, you know, are now kind of have all these cost overruns that, you know, Southern Company needs to effectively pass along the cost to their customers. So that obviously isn't the ideal. So, you know, I guess looping back, nuclear energy is an interesting slice of the pie because it costs so much to put it in place in the first place. And it creates a tremendous amount of pressure and political will to get it done. But once it's in place, it lasts for, you know, 100 years plus, and it's sustainable. But yeah, it's just tough to get a greater share of that pie.
So a utility company to build a nuclear plant, they would leverage an investment bank's services to raise bonds for that project, correct?
Yeah, bonds can be raised for specific projects, or they could just be raised for the company, and then the company can use the money for whatever they want. So in those nuclear plants cases, the utility company in question, you know, set aside a good amount of money to get it built from kind of the corporation level. But it was the, you know, the regional territory level that was going to operate it going forward. So the bonds were kind of raised at that entity to help fund the project. So when all of this stuff went south, you actually saw, you know, the bonds that were raised at that entity, not necessarily for the project, but at that entity, go sideways. And they've been kind of trying to deal with it ever since.
Well, that's really insightful. And while we're talking about energy generation, you know, most markets ebb and flow. There's a rise and a fall, and the economy has a cycle of rolling over. And same thing with the housing market. When we're looking at, you know, coal and oil and natural gas, are any of these energies in a bubble that's about to burst, or is there going to be a budding energy crisis? Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of prices and where the markets are, the energy markets are?
Yeah, I don't think that there's necessarily a bubble on the horizon because these things move pretty slow. And I think everyone can kind of react to it. You know, it's not a bubble in a traditional sense where, you know, you see, you know, prices, you know, beginning to climb up and you have investors trying to get on the bandwagon and take advantage of the price movement. And, you know, then all of a sudden the music stops and everyone, you know, is left holding the bag. I don't think that's necessarily the case here. The only parallel that I could potentially draw is that, you know, there was a slight bubble when it came to natural gas production and infrastructure being built around it. And whether and there is some criticism as to whether or not natural gas will be the dominant energy provider going forward. So if you, you know, kind of hop in the time machine and go back 10 years, you know, before the natural gas boom really took effect, you know, there really wasn't much infrastructure to get that gas around the country. And you know, out of the ground and into, you know, these generation facilities and then, you know, transfer them into electricity and what have you, that infrastructure just didn't exist. So over the last 15 years, you've seen a huge build out of that. You've seen, you know, huge companies form on the basis that the natural gas boom will continue and that the infrastructure is needed. And that is going to be America's, you know, energy policy going forward, that, you know, most of it is going to come from natural gas. And then you saw the utility companies kind of respond to it by building, you know, natural gas, you know, generation plants, investing in pipeline companies that, you know, take the natural gas from point A to point B, building out their own infrastructures to an extent, making large investments in it, hoping that, you know, it'll pan out for the next 10 to 20 years. Now, whether or not natural gas is going to be the dominant player 10 or 20 years from now, you know, I guess is a topic of debate, because there's some utility companies that decided not to fully engage in the natural gas bubble or boom, whatever you want to call it, and skip straight to renewable. And maybe those are the utilities that will get rewarded, you know, in 10, 15 years time.
Yeah, I've heard this analogy a few times. You know, natural gas is like the hybrid car of energy. You know, it's not quite 100% renewable, but it is definitely a stepping stone to that energy transition, that clean energy transition.
Yeah, exactly. It's considered a gap fuel, going from fossil fuel to renewable. And I think some utility companies, you know, maybe viewed it more as a gap fuel than others.
Got it. Here's a question for you. Now, when a utility company is determining that pie chart, that their energy portfolio, what are the pros and cons and maybe some of the decision-making process they use there to determine, you know, how highly weighted they are with a conservative fossil fuel mix versus, you know, a progressive clean energy mix?
Yeah, there's a couple different factors that they look at.
Prices, supply.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's an economical, you know, decision at the end of the day. Typically, you know, it's whether or not they think there's a market for this type of energy going forward, whether they can source it cheaply, and whether or not that mix is right for their service territory. Like I said before, a service commission or a public utility in the Southwest will have a much different mix than one in the Northwest. You know, the Southwest will have predominantly solar because they'll take advantage of that renewable resource, and in the north it'll probably be, you know, hydroelectric. Now, when it comes to changing the portfolio over time, which I think is what all these utility companies are always thinking about, they're going to figure out, you know, they're going to create kind of projections. They're going to create projections from economic models that they have on what the demographic is going to look like for their service territory, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, based on, you know, all these, you know, economic consensuses. And they're going to come up with like a load number. They're going to say, this is how much, you know, power our territory is going to consume in the year 2025. Now, what mix of electricity is going to be most cost efficient for us in 2025 versus what our mix is today based on where we think prices are going to go for each one of the different, you know, energy pools we can tap into. And then on top of that, there's a layer of, well, what's the investment cost to bring our, you know, coal capacity from 25% down to 10% and, you know, increasing our natural gas from 65 to 80%. You know, is there a, is the cost benefit analysis there? Does that make sense for us over, you know, the 7-year time horizon that we're looking at? And, you know, they're going to do that for every single one of their segments, and they're going to kind of factor in all these different variables and come up with an assumption and just kind of stick to a game plan, but, you know, make tweaks to it yearly. But once you kind of identify the, you know, the right mix in a target year, they are going to, you know, begin making longer term investments by, you know, building out the infrastructure that's required to actually, you know, generate that electricity or transfer it, or, you know, be able to accommodate that mix in the future. So yeah, it's interesting. It's a lot of different variables, probably more variables than we can discuss on a podcast.
Yeah. Well, switching gears a little bit, you were recently in Austin. It was amazing catching up with you. We were walking down South Congress Street, and you were sharing this incredible story about prohibition in the 20s, the 1920s, and the 30s, which I found absolutely fascinating, and how its effects are still impacting us today. Could you reshare that story to the listeners?
Yeah, this story blew my mind too, so I'm glad you're bringing it up. From various different sources that I pieced together, specifically this documentary that I watched a couple of years ago called Fuel. It's on Netflix, I think. So for all the listeners, you know, jump on Netflix and take a look whenever you get a chance. The story goes like this. So back in the early 1900s, you had the Rockefeller oil interests kind of gaining notoriety and power, especially through the late 1800s, and demand for oil was skyrocketing, especially because of Vanderbilt and his railroads and Carnegie and his steel. They were able to build out this railroad infrastructure that spanned across America and required Rockefeller's oil to effectively power these locomotives and all the machinery that's required to continue this expansion. Now, Rockefeller knew that he needed to protect his interests as the rise of the automobile presented itself. Now, you know, with Henry Ford's, you know, assembly line breakthrough and, you know, the advent of everybody in America basically having an affordable car, that presented, you know, a huge opportunity for Rockefeller to make the combustion engine basically the end all be all, you know, user of oil and gasoline. And he knew, and the people that produced these engines also knew, that the engines can actually run off of gasoline, but they can also be run off of alcohol. It's a very easy tweak, and even you know, cars these days, a certain number of cars, and it depends on the geography, but a lot of them can accept ethanol in substitute of gasoline, and ethanol is nothing more than just a slight variant of alcohol. Now, back then, Rockefeller knew that, you know, he couldn't let these, you know, combustion engines all of a sudden be powered by alcohol. That would obviously completely ruin his oil empire. So he went to Washington. He lobbied, you know, Congress and, you know, work through the back channels to effectively come up with this grandmaster plan of let's make alcohol illegal. And hence prohibition came forth. Now, everybody in the country and in the world thinks that prohibition was because the government was trying to protect consumers of alcohol, like people. But the actual consumers that were, you know, being prevented from using alcohol were, you know, combustion engine automobiles.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, typical government, but
it's pretty mind blowing. Ethanol.
In other countries throughout the world, like Brazil, for example, their vehicles are powered by like a gas blend with 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. And here it's like literally the flip.
Exactly.
Some vehicles, flex fuel vehicles, only have like a 15% ethanol blend, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you watch this fuel documentary, it goes into kind of the arguments as to why, you know, gasoline shouldn't be purely ethanol, or, you know, the opposite end of the argument there, because people say, well, if it's you know, 100% ethanol, that means that you're destroying food stock, because, you know, the ethanol is usually sourced from corn or other you know, vegetation that can produce it. So they're saying, well, you know, that's a complete waste of food. Why would you do that? Why would you grow all this crop and then just use it for fuel? But, you know, I think the other side of that argument is you can produce enough corn sustainably to feed people and cars. So it's an interesting documentary there.
Generation has Elon Musk, so we won't have to be dealing with this for too much longer.
Exactly. We can just leapfrog this whole, you know, debate and just go straight to a more renewable, sustainable source of power.
Yeah. Well, In wrapping up here, I have a few more questions for you. You know, looking forward, where do you see the utility industry going in terms of its energy generation portfolio? You know, is it going to be going more renewable, more clean energy, or are the fossil fuels just so embedded in the mix that things really aren't going to change so too much?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to depend on the geographies in which they operate. I think some are going to be slower than others to adapt to kind of the global trend towards greener. I honestly firmly think that, you know, in 20 to 30 years time, we're going to see the utility companies of America source most of their energy needs from renewable resources. It just makes sense. Wow. You know, for them, you know, once they create the infrastructure, right, and once they make that initial investment, they reap the rewards of it for free forever, you know, barring any cost to maintain, you know, the panels or the wind farms or, you know, the dams or whatever it might be. They don't need to buy fuel to put through that system like they have to do with natural gas or oil or coal. So for them, it's kind of a no-brainer. It's just a matter of how efficient that initial investment is going to be for them. So I think as wind farms, as solar, as hydro and geothermal, as all of these get more efficient over time, it becomes a much easier cost benefit analysis to jump on the renewable wagon versus being a defender of kind of the older fossil fuel systems. And it's just going to make sense for everybody. But it's a gradual process. You know, they also want to be able to get the return on the investment that they put in to all these legacy systems as well for as long as they can, until, you know, pumping in more natural gas into their generation facility doesn't outweigh the, you know, the 3 or 5 year time horizon cost of building out solar that will completely substitute that generation. Every utility company is going to have their own break-even analysis when they have to kind of cross that bridge. Thinking about it in simple terms, why would you not, you know, have most of your energy come from a source that you don't have to pay for anymore?
Yeah. And Texas has really done a great job in terms of wind farm generation. Over the recent years, they've invested heavily in building out wind farms. Mm-hmm. And the PUC released an article that showed rates overnight actually went negative, meaning if you were using electricity at night, you were getting paid to use that electricity because there was excess wind supply capacity. capacity in the utility grid that it was actually a credit to the customers that were using energy overnight, which I found completely fascinating.
That is awesome. And here in New York, there's, you know, our utility company here is Con Edison, and they actually provide customers the option of picking which energy source they want their electricity to come from. So Con Ed, you know, produces their own energy via, you know, a very thoughtful mix of different sources. But rather than going through Con Edison for not only distribution, but also the source, you can also pick these other sources of energy that can run through the Con Edison distribution system. These companies are called ESCOs, or energy service companies. And they work with Con Edison to effectively, you know, provide them the power that they can then go ahead and distribute to customers that elect to receive power from that ESCO. And there's certain ESCOs that have more of a green slant than others. And in many cases, the ESCO that you choose can actually lower your electric bill below what Con Edison would give you if you otherwise just chose Con Edison to provide you, as well as source you the energy that you need.
Right. And Con Edison is the default provider, and the rate there is variable. The supply rate is variable. And New York, for the listeners, is a deregulated energy market. Austin is a municipality, meaning the city actually owns the electric grid as well as the energy supply. So in a deregulated market, ratepayers, both business and residential, have the luxury of choosing their provider, what source of energy they want to feed their home or businesses. And they can also lock in that rate over a 1, 2, or 5 year term.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I just switched over to a different ESCO recently, and you know, our electricity bill is probably 25% cheaper than what it was before. And, you know, I have the full confidence that the energy is actually coming from a mix of solar and wind versus, you know, whatever Con Edison was able to provide me.
That's great. Yeah, I've chosen to do the same thing, both with my business and where I live. You know, all of my energy comes from 100% Texas wind.
That's awesome.
One question for me, and I know you need to make your disclaimer here, but for the listeners who have investments in the utility space, can you shed some light on maybe where you see things, you know, good investments, bad investments, things to be careful of? And mm-hmm. I know you have a disclaimer.
Yeah, my disclaimer is anything that I say right now should not be construed as investment advice, and you should consult with your own professional investment consultant on making any investment decisions. With that disclaimer out of the way, I would say that there are, you know, a host of different publicly traded utility companies that anybody can purchase, and it would be a good addition to your portfolio in the context of, you know, an appropriate mix of other asset classes and other sectors that give you a well-diversified portfolio. So I wouldn't say to your listeners out there, you know, if you're gung-ho on energy and gung-ho on, you know, renewable energy specifically, put all your eggs in one basket and only buy, you know, renewable energy companies in your portfolio. That's not the right investment advice, and that's not the right recommendation. Everybody should have, you know, a certain percentage of their portfolio dedicated to energy. And then within that energy bucket, you should make, you know, sound investments that you think make sense, that fit a certain profile that you're trying to target. So within that bucket, I would say that there are a couple of utility companies in the country that have definitely taken a leadership role in becoming more renewable friendly. NextEra Energy is one that kind of comes to mind. They're the big utility company that's based out of Florida, and they have service territories all over the country, but predominantly in Florida. They've made leaps and bounds in terms of, you know, creating the most renewable centric mix of energy. which I think is great exposure to just the renewable space overall, because they are, like I said, they're leaders in the space, and they continue to kind of push other renewable companies to circle around their needs. And they are just huge consumers of PVs and you know, wind farms and all sorts of different, you know, renewable sources at this point, that I think the industry is kind of huddling around them and viewing them as kind of the best in class type of utility when it comes to this stuff. So I would highly recommend them. Outside of those guys, I mean, natural gas is still obviously a play that won't go away for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. So if you're trying to buttress your portfolio to not only take advantage of kind of the longer term or long run trend, which is towards renewable, but also capture that kind of short term demand with natural gas, I think some of the bigger pipeline companies in the U.S. are attractive investments. There's a couple larger names, larger companies that own a lot of that infrastructure. And when you own the pipeline companies themselves, there's not much risk in terms of commodity price, because these guys usually just have, you know, contracts that are fixed with end suppliers and users, and they're just kind of using their pipelines as tolls, or as toll roads rather. So they're kind of stable in that sense. But as long as natural gas continues to be a big source of energy for these large utility companies, you know, all the gas that flows through them will keep them in business. So I think a pipeline company is kind of a natural place to land for an intermediate term investment. So some of the higher rated companies and higher quality companies in the U.S. would be like Magellan Midstream or Enterprise Product Partners. There's a host of them. There's a couple of them that are in MLP format versus C Corp format, which, you know, might pose some risks, and we can talk offline what the differences are between the two. But I'd say those are two good areas to start. Like any utility companies that are renewable focused, that will continue to make those investments for the long term. And then for the short to intermediate term, the pipeline companies that are transporting natural gas across the country.
Got it. Here's the last question for you. We talked briefly, we dropped Elon Musk's name, Tesla. When we're thinking of electric vehicles and how these auto manufacturers have been announcing, you know, full fleets of electric vehicles coming in, you know, 2019 and 2020, how are utility companies preparing or failing to prepare for this massive influx of EVs, electric vehicles, that are going to be plugged into the grid at everyone's homes overnight over the next decade?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a paradigm shift, to be honest, that they've already kind of figured out. What they're doing is they're making all the investments to increase the load capacity on their system, right? So if there's an influx of electric vehicles being plugged in onto the grid, they're already making the investments for, you know, these cars to come online and you know, have enough power to get juiced and drive around. Now on the flip side,
by issuing the bonds, right?
The bonds are just kind of an ongoing investment. I mean, I don't think that any utility companies are raising bonds specifically to build out, a certain segment of their grid versus others. I think for the most part, they just know that load capacity, the amount that they can actually generate on a daily basis, are the two numbers that they have in mind. And okay, they're just going to continue to make those investments to power their grid as a whole. In terms of, you know, increased electric demand from cars specifically, though, you know, that means that over time there'll be a paradigm shift from fossil fuel driven cars to electric driven cars. So that means that the demand for fossil fuels, gasoline and oil, you know, should go down over time. And the demand for, you know, electricity will go up. And for any of those utility companies that didn't make, you know, huge investments into renewable resources to power their grid, they should actually, you know, on the flip side, see somewhat of a tailwind benefit of there being a decreased demand for gasoline and oil. And they should be able to kind of buy up that energy on the cheap for their legacy systems to, you know, kind of continue operating and still give them the, you know, the appropriate load demand that'll be required for their service territory. So I think in either case, companies that made the right investments that will be renewable focused will have enough energy to kind of go around for all the influx of electric vehicles. But as well as for those that are kind of on the tail end, those guys should be okay too because of lower fossil fuel costs. And I'll just say, just to end it off, I mean, when we think about the future and electric cars, you know, I think a lot of us kind of think of the model of the infrastructure that's in place for gasoline powered cars. Like, you know, you drive your car to a gas station, you pump it with fuel at a pump and you drive off. Now, I think the early iteration of electric cars has seen kind of something similar. So you have like the Tesla charge up stations here and there. But I think in the future, when you have, you know, a proliferation of electric vehicles on the road and that just becomes the standard, I mean, I wouldn't be too surprised. And I don't think it's too far-fetched to say that you'll just have kind of embedded charging mechanisms within the ground on, like, you know, highways and streets and parking lots where you just simply drive over them and you're not even actually consuming energy. You're actually charging up as you're driving along. So, I mean, that is the ultimate, I think, goal of an electric world and a world where there's electric cars is, you know, you're free to drive it wherever you want and you never have to even worry about charging it. And, you know, whoever the electric grid is in that area where those charging streets or charging spots are just responsible for that area. And you as a consumer, you know, you pay by the second or by the minute in whatever service territory that you're in. So it doesn't even come down to, like, you know, you paying an extra bill at home because that's where you're charging your electric car. I think in 50 or 100 years, it's just wherever you are is whoever you're paying it to.
Amazing. Well, Prav, I'm so happy I was able to pin you down. And this has been incredibly enlightening and just fantastic. So thanks so much for joining me today on the show.
Of course. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate being on. And, you know, if any of the listeners have any questions, I encourage them to reach out. You can reach me on my email, prathready@gmail.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Sounds great, man.
All right. Awesome. Thanks, Jeff.
If you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. And to receive our latest episodes in your inbox, join the Insiders list below.